world's oldest gorilla living at Berlin Zoo. At this age, the Western lowland gorilla is what Berlin Zoo calls almost something of a legend. Gorillas living in the wild have a life expectancy of about 40 years, and at 65, she has been the world's oldest living gorilla for a while. 65 is absolutely extraordinary, and that obviously needs to be celebrated in style.
They mainly get vegetables, and the sugar they receive at malls is fruit sugar, and that's what she saw for today in the shape of raspberries and blueberries. They were the decoration on rice cake made of boiled rice, a thin layer of rice and some curd so it sticks together. The bottom was made of a lot of green stuff, then the lion and lettuce.
According to Berlin Zoo, Western lowland gorillas are now an endangered species after their natural habitat was continuously decimated, and therefore fewer and fewer animals live in the tropical rainforest of Cameroon, the Central African Republic, Gabon, and the Republic of Congo.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
After Kushner met in secret with MBS, America's ally and the ruler of Saudi Arabia, MBN was arrested and thrown into prison where he remains to this day. As a result, Jared's buddy, MBS, now runs the kingdom and controls its money, says Tom Hardman, writer, in an article titled "Jared Kushner Sold Out to Saudis for $2 Billion and Nobody Seems to Care." Stay tuned for more. After President John F. Kennedy appointed his brother as Attorney General, Republicans freaked out and passed an anti-nepotism law against presidents hiring family members. When Donald Trump put Jared Kushner into the White House, even after he failed a security clearance, his Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel ruled essentially that Trump could ignore the law. Saudi Arabia was then run by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Nayef, or MBN, the grandson of the nation's founder, King Abdulaziz, MBN's father, Nayef bin Abdulaziz, had run the country before him. Like his father and grandfather, MBN was tight with U.S. intelligence agencies and committed to a stable long-term relationship with the United States and Europe. When Trump came into office in 2017, MBN's cousin, Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS, was merely one of many Saudi princes joking for position and power in the kingdom. At the time Trump appointed Kushner in 2017, U.S. intelligence and the State Department were concerned that if MBS were to overthrow MBN, the consequences could be unpredictable for the United States. Kushner, with his new security clearance in hand, would have had access to that information. Things were getting wild in the kingdom. MBS wanted to overthrow MBN, and according to some extraordinary reporting from Vicky Ward, Jarrett saw an opportunity to go around U.S. interests and help MBS overthrow and imprison his cousin to MBS could seize control of the kingdom and its more than $700 billion. Four well-placed sources, she reports, say that the primary reason Kushner has now received $2 billion is that he helped MBS depose MBN. Knowing that this went directly against what U.S. intelligence wanted or thought was good for national security, Kushner has always said he did not give U.S. intelligence to the Saudis. Suddenly, the news was full of stories about members of the Saudi royal family who were being held by security forces in fancy hotels, some being tortured and a few even vanished. After Kushner met in secret with MBS, America's ally and the ruler of Saudi Arabia, MBN, was arrested and thrown into prison where he remains to this day. As a result, Jared's body, MBS, now runs the kingdom and controls its money. David Ignatius of the Washington Post noted a few weeks after MBS began arresting his royal political foes, apparently using information from inside U.S. intelligence agencies. It was probably no accident that last month Jared Kushner, Trump's senior advisor and son-in-law, made a personal visit to Riyadh. The two princes are said to have stayed up until nearly 4 a.m. several nights swapping stories and planning strategy. Did Jared sell out American interests for $2 billion? It was with MBS that President Trump negotiated a 2.2 million barrels a day production cut in 2020, when the pandemic had crashed demand for oil. It was MBS who reportedly said he had Jared in his pocket. It was MBS who reportedly had Washington Post writer Jamal Khashoggi murdered and dismembered by an assassination squad when visiting a Saudi embassy to get a visa to marry his fiancée. And the New York Times notes it was Jared who was there for MBS when he needed a friend on the inside. As the killing set off a firestorm around the world and American intelligence agencies concluded that it was ordered by Prince Mohammed, MBS, Mr. Kushner became the prince's most important defender inside the White House. It's MBS who the Wall Street Journal reports is now moving his country closer to enemies to punish President Joe Biden. It's also MBS who is today refusing to take President Biden's calls about restoring that oil production, which would reduce oil prices and relieve much of the political pressure now on Biden and Democrats as we head toward the 2022 and 2024 elections. Have we all been witnessing a young con man walk away with billions after selling out Yemen, Khashoggi, and the United States? With virtually no questions from mainstream media or Congress, the son of a professional grifter, Charles Kushner, who was pardoned by Trump, and a minor slumlord Jared is said to have gotten advice from a PR professional when his father went to prison. Ben Walsh noted for Huffington Post that Jared's dad tells the story that his PR friend advised Jared. Step 1. Buy a New York newspaper. Don't be too particular. Any newspaper will do. Step 2. Buy a big Manhattan building. Any building will do. Step 3. Marry the daughter of a rich New York family. Anyone will do. Jared, the story goes, then purchased the New York Observer newspaper, overpaid for 666 Fifth Avenue office building just down the street from Trump Tower, and now impressively credentialed as a serious guy hooked up with Donald Trump's daughter Ivanka. From there, it was a straight shot to the White House, and then cashing in with $2 billion from Saudi Arabia, authorized by MBS, who had no override his investment advisors to hand the cash to Jared, which is a crime. U.S. Constitution contains two emollient clauses, both forbidding officials from taking gifts from foreign governments. The most well-known one in Article 2 forbids presidents from taking what could be bribes. The second, from Article 1 of the Constitution, forbids such behavior by anybody working in the federal government without the explicit permission of Congress. No person holding any office of profit or trust under the United States shall, without the consent of the Congress, accept any present emolument, office, or title of any kind whatever from any king, prince, or foreign state. As the Congressional Research Service, CRS, notes, the purpose of the Foreign Emoluments Clause is to prevent corruption and limit foreign influence on federal officers. The clause grew out of farmers' experience with the European custom of gift-giving to foreign diplomats, which the Articles of Confederation prohibited. Following that precedent, the Foreign Clause prohibits federal officers from accepting foreign presents without congressional consent. History will tell us if Jared Kushner sold out his country and damaged the prospects for peace in the world by helping MBS rise to our power and then push Saudi Arabia toward other countries just to get his hands on a few billion dollars. But that story is being written today. And if there was ever a scandal more worthy of a DOJ and congressional investigation than Benghazi or Hillary's emails, this is it.
Rules of engagement.
We want to know more about what Israeli soldiers have to tell about their rules of engagement, the truth behind the occupation. And for that, we move to Tel Aviv. In a non-disclosed location, there is a small office. The exact location will not be disclosed for security reasons. Here, we are going to meet former soldiers of the Israeli military forces, members of an organization that defies the occupation, breaking the silence.
My name is Yehuda Shaul. I grew up in what you would call the political right in Israel. I was an infantry combat soldier and a commander. I finished my service as a company sergeant. My sisters are settlers. One of my brothers is a settler today. Even though I grew up in the political right, I found myself in a place where I couldn't justify any more 90% of actions I took part in.
But after serving Israeli military forces as a combat soldier, he decided to do something that changed his life forever. He was the first Israeli soldier to tell the truth about the occupation of Palestine.
I really hope that I'll see the end of the occupation. The first real place I was deployed was Hebron. The second I arrived in Hebron, I started having doubts.
December 2016. The United Nations Security Council approves Resolution 2334. It reaffirms that Israeli settlements in Palestinian land are illegal and a violation of the international law. A few weeks later, with Donald Trump already in the White House, Israel announces the expansion of the West Bank settlements.
Between the United States and the State of Israel.
It means more settlers to add to the 600,000 that are now living in Palestinian land.
In the occupied territories in general, you basically have two communities, Palestinians and settlers. These two communities do not have the same rights. Palestinians are under military law, enforced by the army, and settlers are under Israeli civilian law, enforced by the Israeli police. So I arrived to Hebron, and my mission is to protect the settlers.
They come from all over the world, invited by Jewish organizations and travel agencies working for the settlers' cause.
I come from Los Angeles. I flew 15 hours yesterday to come show support for Israel.
Heavily guarded by Israeli soldiers, every tour of hate contributes to putting more pressure on Palestinians. On the days of the tours, Palestinians are with a gun at their heads, sieged inside their houses, while settlers explain to the tourists how they conquered the land. The first advice to the tourists is, keep away from the Palestinians or you will be killed. Settlers create hate tourism. The goal? Bring more settlers to set down in Palestinian land.
I'm Achia Chatz. I'm 30 years old and I served in a special unit called Dubdevan, specialized in counter-terror inside the West Bank specifically. Now, what's special about my unit is that it does undercover operations.
For at least half an hour, four men had been throwing stones at Israeli soldiers. But in a matter of seconds, they pulled out their guns, opening fire at the group of protesters.
We have soldiers, fighters, that know how to assimilate within the Palestinian society. They speak Arab, they dress as Arab.
The four men are, in fact, Israeli soldiers disguised as Palestinian. They are known as Mustarabim, an Arabic term that literally means Arab pretenders, infiltrators among Palestinians to carry out military missions.
With that ability, we're able to specific missions from kidnapping or stopping all kind of terrorists or wanted to complicated and even classified operations.
They also carry out selective executions. It was 12th of November 2015. About two dozen men wearing bulky jackets barged into a Palestinian hospital, pushing what appeared to be a pregnant woman in a wheelchair. But they were not heading to the delivery ward. The people caught on the hospital were, in fact, undercover Israeli officers. About 10 minutes later, the Israelis were on their way out, leaving behind a Palestinian man dead and taking his cousin with them.
And I remember really clearly, they divide us to two groups, and we're standing one in front of another. And then they told us, you need to imagine that you're going into the field. They're a Palestinian, a terrorist. And he's gonna shoot your mom, rape your sister, and he's gonna kill your little brother. And right before you go in, this is how you need to be in your mind.
I'll just give you one example, what we call in the IDF, making our presence felt. We start night shift patrol, 10 o'clock to 6 o'clock in the morning, 8-hour shift. We walk in the streets, bump into a house, It's a random house. The sergeant, the officer who leads the patrol, chooses these houses, wake up the family.
Now it's the middle of the night, around 3-4 o'clock in the morning. We have our weapon, our face is covered with colors, so it would be intimidating.
Lock them in one room, separate men from women, search the place. You can yourself imagine the dynamics, what happens when a military unit bumps into your house, 2 o'clock at night.
We knock on the door, the head of the family opens the door. The first time we realize this is a family we're going into.
Knock on some doors, make some noise, throw some shock grenades. Run to the other corner of the street, invade another random house. Wake up the next family.
Open all the doors, open all the lights, open all the windows. Wake up all your family and bring them here to the living room. We need to question you.
Search the place, you know, climb on the roof, jump from one roof to another, go down through the balcony, wake up the next house.
Really exciting on one point, because this is the first time you're out there. On the other hand, this is not exactly the war zone that I was looking for, or I was really anticipating for.
That's basically how you pass here at Auschwitz. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. From September 2000, when the second Intifada started, till today, it didn't stop for 1 second.
I remember one of the main operations that I've done. It was this big operation. We were all very proud of it. We decided we need to do a thing called a hot operation. Get into a house through blowing up the door with explosives. And the guy with the explosives put explosives on the door, and he put a little bit more. And we go and we hide in the corner, and 3, 2, 1, and huge boom went off. And I really remember it, and also seen it later on the camera. And right after the boom, we quickly go inside. Looks like the house was picking up in the air and thrown down. All the windows were broken, the doors were torn, and we quickly find the guy, we take him outside, we put him against the wall, and there's something really weird. The guy doesn't look like the guy that we're looking for, and the house doesn't exactly look like the house that was supposed to break in. Then we notice we blew up the wrong house, and we go out to the next corner, find the right house, and continue the mission.
Almost on a weekly basis, I would sit down with my soldiers and talk about values and morality. I remember one Thursday, you know, you just finish sitting down talking about values, and then you start a patrol, and you walk in the streets of the old city, and suddenly we see a suspicious bag on the side of the road. Could be a bomb. Could be garbage. Both happened. What do? We grab the first random Palestinian and send him to pick it up. If it's a bomb, it would explode. If not, we continue. 2 hours ago, we spoke about the equality of human life, and now every human being. And now we just proved that the life of a random Palestinian in the street is worth less than what? One bullet of an M16 that we can shoot it and check whether it's a bomb or not? 20 minutes waiting for a bomb, you know, engineer? What is obvious for me is that protecting Israel from terrorism is a very small part of what we do. What we mainly do in the occupied territories, it's about making sure Palestinians will never be free.
We are going back to Jerusalem Al-Quds to meet a so-called NGO. They call themselves My Truth, and the organization was born in the social media.
Controversy is being stirred up in Israel involving one of the country's most polarizing activist groups.
They stand for the values of Zionism, and their goal, tell the truth about the occupation of Palestine. But their truth denies any violation of human rights, killings, or even the occupation. Their members are veterans of the Israeli military forces and were created to fight breaking the silence.
My name is Lior Shahat. I've served in the IDF. I'm also a part of an organization called My Truth.
My name is Ben. I served in the IDF. My Truth was open up in direct response to breaking the silence.
My name is Eitan Meir. I'm the International Relations Coordinator for Im Tirtzu. I was born and raised in New Jersey in the United States, and I immigrated to Israel in 2008. Im Tirtzu, it's a non-governmental organization, and its goals are simple: to promote and advance Zionist values in Israel.
Do you think breaking the silence are traitors?
Breaking the Silence gets millions and millions of shekels, foreign governmental entities in Europe, Denmark, Holland, Spain, even Germany, France. I don't know what their ultimate goal is in Breaking the Silence and all these other organizations that receive funding from foreign European governments in order to defame and delegitimize the State of Israel. I look at their actions, and their actions are 100% anti-Israel.
How do you feel when the Minister of Defense say that you are traitors?
Just say,
Moshe Ya'alon, the former Israeli Minister of Military Affairs, says openly that Breaking the Silence is an organization of traitors and that they were banned from all military events. Lieutenant General Moshe Ya'alon, Defense Minister of Israel, after all the controversy and war crimes committed under his orders during the last operation in Gaza, he says, I can still look at myself in the mirror.
I can look to myself in the mirror.
About the cases open in several civil courts across the world, he has an explanation. The world is lying.
When the Minister of Defense calls you a traitor and a spy, people on the street respond to this incitement, and then our office gets physically attacked once, our activists get physically attacked twice on campuses. And right-wing bullies published phone number of and the grandparents of our executive director, and they've been getting calls in the middle of the night. Your granddaughter was in a car accident, she's dead, she's in the hospital. Yeah, it's becoming very filthy. What we see in the last few years is more and more attempts by the government to try to silence anyone who speaks out about the occupation.
This is the website of Breaking the Silence. Here you can find hundreds of testimonies of soldiers that served the occupation in Gaza and the West Bank. They tell about crimes committed against the Palestinians. Abuse. Assassinations. Bribery. Confirmation of killings. Deaths. Everything documented with place, date, and names.
Also, a lot of times they find that, you know, with Breaking the Silence, a lot of their stories are not true. And you have the commanders of these soldiers coming and saying, hey, I was there. That's not how it played out. What are you talking about?
Breaking the Silence, it felt bad for me to see how they act.
I was there. I served in the army. I was in very difficult situations in the Golani Brigade. And these things Breaking the Silence says did not happen. They either did not happen or exaggerated. And they certainly do not reflect the general doctrine of the IDF. So when you have Israelis going abroad and slandering the country, how could you expect the people of Europe to think otherwise?
My Truth is trying to fight against the rising support that Breaking the Silence is achieving around the world, among human rights organizations, but also governments.
There was a settler NGO financed by the Israeli government sending spies undercover into activist groups and human rights organizations to try to spread paranoia, and it's kind of like a Stasi-type behavior. They try to send us people who will give us false testimony so we will publish and lose our credibility. They send two guys undercover to our activist group, becoming friends with people, embraced by people, being brought into the homes of people while everything is recorded from hidden cameras. They sent a guy to give us state secrets about classified operations behind enemy lines in Syria so they can initiate a security investigation against us. Now, our researcher sits down with this guy, and during the interview, he insists four or five times to talk about Syria. And our researcher tells him, we're not interested in Syria. Let's move on, go back to the West Bank and Gaza. And right away, we sent this interview to the Israeli military censorship. And later on, we were able to confirm that the guy was a mole, was a spy for the settler organization. Then we released it to the media. You have a settler organization with Israeli government funding sending a soldier to breach national security laws to give a state secret so they can initiate an investigation against us. It's the opposite of anything that makes sense. That's how far the Israeli political right has gone to try to silence anyone who speaks out against the occupation.
Breaking the Silence, you have to realize this is the credible minority of it. And in those cases that they are found to do it, there are laws. And
they say because soldiers are afraid to join Breaking the Silence.
Anyone that's been to Israel, and I encourage all the viewers to do so, will realize that Israelis are the last people, I would say, have a problem about speaking their mind.
Do you think there are many soldiers preparing to speak out inside the IDF? They are afraid to do it?
Yeah, what we know is that the Israeli government is trying to do many different things to try to make sure that soldiers will not speak out. For example, they're now taking us to court to force us to expose the identity of soldiers who served in Gaza in 2014 and testify to us so they can throw it into prison.
Every day during that operation, between 1 to 3 in the afternoon, the IDF had something called a humanitarian ceasefire to allow the local population in Gaza to go out, get the food they need, visit, you know, their relatives, breathe some fresh air. When you go to an organization like Hamas, unfortunately, that was the time when they would shoot the most rockets. We decided not to do anything because we decided it was a ceasefire, and we just allowed them to keep firing rockets, putting, you know, Palestinians on top of the Israelis.
Gaza is the most heavily populated enclave on the globe. 1.8 million people, and more than 1 million are refugees that before 1948 lived in what is now the occupation. This strip of land is, in fact, a huge refugee camp, but also an open-air prison, sieged by Israel by land, sea, and air. Last Israeli aggression on Gaza lasted 50 days of intensive bombings. Entire neighborhoods were reduced to rubble. Operation Protective Edge, as it was called by Israel, continued for 7 weeks, leaving behind around 3,000 deaths and around 500,000 Gazans displaced. And if it continues, experts believe, Gaza will become a place where no humans can live.
I would say the findings that we have after interviewing today over 80, not over 90, soldiers and officers who served in Operation Protective Edge is that the massive amount of civilian casualties, over 1,000 civilians, over 500 children, the massive amount of destruction of infrastructure, civilian infrastructure. Yeah, about 18,000 apartments destroyed. It's not a coincidence. It's a direct result of two new doctrines that the IDF has adopted that shaped the way this operation was conducted, led to this destruction that we left behind. One sentence of four words that every Israeli combat soldier grows on. Yesh safek, en safek. When there is doubt, there is no doubt. If you're in a situation of doubt, you're not sure what the rules of engagement are, you don't see clear the target, the orders are to shoot to the knees and the bottom, and you're afraid you're gonna hit the stomach, you have no doubt, you don't pull the trigger. Because once you pull the trigger, there is no way back. In Gaza, the same sentence was used, exactly the opposite. There is doubt, there is no doubt. If you have doubt, if you're not sure, pull the trigger, because we prefer the mistakes to be at the expense of the other side.
You know, we don't have any red lines anymore for our security. Don't we stop somewhere and say, am I going to do this in the name of security, really? You might say it's security, but I know that this is not my values.
The problem is the occupation. Any army in the world that will get the order to go and occupy another people forever will behave this way. And the only way you can do this is if you don't see Palestinians as equal human beings to you. Because to an equal human being to you, you just don't do this. That is immoral. And it's because the mission is immoral, our behavior was immoral. The problem is the political mission the army is sent to carry out. Hence, the solution is ending the occupation, is changing the political mission the army is sent to carry out.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the United States, Republican Representative Matt Gaetz compared the challenge against Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene's eligibility to run for re-election to the Rwandan Civil War, saying that barring Americans from office should never happen in our America. The article you're about to hear has been written by Thomas Keeker, a journalist writing for Newsweek magazine. In the United States, Republican Representative Matt Gaetz compared the challenge against Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene's eligibility to run for re-election to the Rwandan Civil War, saying that barring Americans from office should never happen in our America. This should never have been allowed to occur to my colleague, but if I know anything about Marjorie Taylor Greene, she's tougher than they are, Matt Gaetz told One American News on Monday. Matt Gaetz added, she'll come out of this even stronger, but we've got to think about legislation or something at the federal level to simply allow people to be candidates in elections. This is like Rwanda stuff, saying that, well, we've deemed you an enemy of the state, so you can't run for office. For goodness sake, that should never happen in our America, the congressman added. The civil war in Rwanda began on 1st of October 1990 after the rebel Rwandan Patriotic Front constructed all Tutsis as enemies of the state and launched a genocide that spanned 100 days. A group of Georgia voters in Marjorie Taylor Greene's congressional district are challenging the congresswoman's eligibility to run for re-election under the 14th Amendment's Insurrection Clause, alleging that Marjorie Taylor Greene helped facilitate the January 6th Capitol riot. In a challenge filed last month in the court, the group of voters in Georgia alleged that before, on, and after 6th of January 2021, Marjorie Taylor Greene voluntarily aided and engaged in an insurrection to obstruct the peaceful transfer of presidential power, disqualifying her from serving as a member of Congress. On Monday, Republican Representative Matt Gaetz, who attended last week's court hearings in Atlanta, Georgia, in support of his Republican colleague, Marjorie Taylor Greene, claimed that the reason Marjorie Taylor Greene and Representative Madison Cawthorn, another controversial GOP congressman from North Carolina, are being questioned as politicians is because Democrats lack an evenly matched candidate to run in those districts. I think there are a number of places where the left knows that they can't win the election with the voters, and so they're trying to use a legal process to deprive voters of even being able to make a choice, the Florida congressman said. Representative Matt Gaetz from Florida said, the reason Democrats have to do this is because they don't have an actual agenda to run on that's popular with anyone. And so they're using fear as a political tool. That's the 6th of January committee. That's this, you know, bringing up the ghosts of white supremacy to try to construct a bunch of fear around that. And then in the electoral space, they're trying to channel that fear construction into tactical steps to remove people from the ballot. Republican congressman from Florida, Matt Gaetz, said legal challenges like the ones against Marjorie Taylor Greene are not only sending a message to individual politicians, but to everyone who is in our government or running for positions in our government. Don't talk about these things, or we will turn the power of the regime against you. Despite the threat to Marjorie Taylor Greene's eligibility, the Congresswoman has remained optimistic that she will not only win re-election following the 24th of May primaries, but that the GOP will win back the House of Representatives in the midterm elections this November. Over the weekend, Marjorie Taylor Greene said that when the Republicans do, she want to serve on the Oversight, Judiciary and Foreign Affairs Committee. She was stripped of her assignments in February of 2021 after a House vote addressing her endorsement of executing several Democratic figures. Newsweek has reached out to Marjorie Taylor Greene's office for comment. Meanwhile, former President Donald Trump could lose one of his most loyal supporters in Congress if the court rules against Marjorie Taylor Greene. The result of the proceeding, which was triggered following a legal challenge from voters who argued that Marjorie Taylor Greene should be removed from the ballot, could mean that former President Donald Trump stands to lose one of his staunchest supporters in Congress. The group of voters involved with the case is from Marjorie Taylor Greene's congressional district. They filed a lawsuit to have her barred from election over her alleged involvement in the U.S. Capitol riot on 6th of January 2021. They argued that Marjorie Taylor Greene should not be able to hold office. The lawsuit cites a provision in the Constitution's 14th Amendment that was added to prevent former Confederates from seeking office after the American Civil War.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The people of Africa join other masses across the world every year to mark the International Coast Day. Many in Africa, like this protester in South Africa, invoke the name of the late Nelson Mandela in expressing solidarity with Palestinians who are struggling to liberate their land occupied by the Israeli apartheid regime.
The rights that Nelson Mandela fought for and spent all of these years in prison for, that all of those values that the South Africans stand for, that we can stand in solidarity with our government in order to face this oppression that's happening in this land.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today's edition is focusing on the International Coast Day, which is marked globally to draw attention to the continued occupation of Palestine by the Israeli regime. We are asking, what is the significance of this day for the people of Africa? Stay with us as our experts give us their insight.
Coast Day in Africa. Every year, international Coast Day rallies are held worldwide on the last Friday of Ramadan. Since the last Friday of Ramadan was first declared by the late Imam Khomeini in 1979 as the Day of Quds, millions of people, Muslims and non-Muslims, have participated in such rallies each year to draw attention to the continued occupation of Palestine by the Israeli apartheid regime. Since the implantation of the Israeli Zionist regime in Palestine in 1948, Palestinians have suffered immensely.
The struggle by Palestinians for the liberation of their land resonates well with the people of Africa, who also suffered many centuries of slavery and colonialism. A member of South Africa's ruling party, ANC, speaks here during a rally to support Palestinians.
As the ANC, you seek to pledge solidarity with the people of Palestine who have for decades
been oppressed by the apartheid state of Israel. There is no difference in the manner in which the Israeli state is acting versus the manner in which the apartheid state used to act. Their latest attack on people who are praying is absolutely atrocious. We are furthermore here to say that it is time that we implement our resolutions, which includes the issue of downgrading the Israeli embassy in South Africa, because that will send a sign or a message that we are serious about the right of the people of Palestine to self-determination.
Now to discuss Africa's support for Palestine and the International Quds Day, we are joined today by Mr. Abdulrahman Mohamed Ahmed, a Djiboutian political activist who has lived in the Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank. Thanks a lot, sir, for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
We also have with us today Professor Farid Isaac, a Muslim scholar, writer, and anti-apartheid activist. He's also a board member of Africa for Palestine organization. Thanks for joining us, Professor.
The pleasure is mine. The pleasure and the duty is mine.
Okay, let's start off with you, Mr. Ahmed. First, can you tell us, what is the significance of the International Quds Day?
First of all, wa alaikum assalam to all the viewers, and Ramadan Mubarak. The significance of the International Quds Day is really important. It's an annual event that usually it's held on the last Friday of the blessed month of Ramadan. And it was established in 1979 by the late Imam Khomeini, rahimahullah, to actually express support for the Palestinian people, but also to oppose Zionism. And most importantly, the International Quds Day was initiated as a campaign to raise awareness and to raise also the education of the Muslim Ummah as well other communities on the importance of Quds when it comes to the Haram Sharif and the significance for the Muslim community and the Muslim Ummah for the Masjid Al-Aqsa.
For decades, African nations have backed the Palestinian liberation struggle against Israel, seeing in it parallels with their own anti-colonial movements. For instance, South Africans got inspired by the Palestinian struggle, and this contributed in their eventual victory against the apartheid regime. Nelson Mandela's grandson explains here on one of the reasons many in South Africa back the Palestinian liberation movement.
Comrades and friends, I am often asked what is so important to us as South Africans about Palestine's struggle that Madiba declared during his visit in 1995 in Gaza. I quote, that our struggle is yet incomplete without the freedom of the Palestinian people, close quote.
Professor Isaac, now how important is it for the people of Africa to mark the International Quds Day and express solidarity with the Palestinian people?
It's in some ways a connection between the history of the continent, the Palestinian struggle for liberation, and that very iconic event in 1979 that toppled the Shah in Iran. And of course, he wasn't just the Shah of Iran. He was really a symbol of what I said earlier on in relation to Africa, the ongoing economic and political control of the lands of people in the global south, but also some in the global north. And to this extent, the toppling of the Shah's regime and accompanied with this, the declaration of International Al-Quds Day by Imam Khomeini, this symbolizes the triple connection, or the interconnection between our various struggles in the world against international imperialism.
Now, the people of Africa endured years of struggle against colonialism, and therefore many understand what Palestinians are going through under the Israeli apartheid regime.
Speaking last year with France 24, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa pointed to the commonalities between the pain and suffering his country endured during the apartheid era and what the Palestinians are subjected to by the Israeli regime.
We as South Africans are most concerned because the images that we've been seeing of people being prevented to move around, of their homes being destroyed, of people being driven out of their homes before they are bombed, of the Israeli soldiers manhandling people, brings back very terrible memories of our own history and apartheid.
How can this commonality be used to support the aspirations of a free Palestine?
I believe that actually today, the commonality, if there is any commonality between the Palestinian struggle and the African colonial area, should be for the Palestinian people actually to strengthen the resistance path. And then for the other people, for example, us as African actually, we should actually focus on the BDS, the boycott, the disinvestment, and the sanction, which was actually the Palestinian-led movement calling for the end of the apartheid.
The legendary Tanzanian freedom fighter and first president, Mwalimu Nyerere, in expressing solidarity with Palestinians, once said, "We have never hesitated in our support for the right of the people of Palestine to have their own land." This sentiment was also echoed by Nelson Mandela, who famously said that our freedom is incomplete without the freedom of the Palestinians. What needs to be done by the people of Africa to ensure that this aspiration by Mandela and other African leaders is eventually attained?
The complete freedom of Palestine, this is our objective. The complete freedom of the land of Palestine, and in this regard, both national initiatives are helpful. Continent-wide initiatives are also very helpful, and at the very least, these include a complete boycott of Israel, a complete boycott of any dealings with Israel, whether this be diplomatic or economic or political.
The Israeli regime has been trying to infiltrate the African Union as an observer member. In February this year, the African Union summit in Addis Ababa suspended a debate on Israel's accreditation as an observer to the bloc, avoiding a vote that risked creating an unprecedented rift in the 55-member body. Now, addressing their summit, the Palestinian Prime Minister urged the African Union to reject Israel's observer status.
Israel should never be rewarded for its violation and for the apartheid regime it does impose on the Palestinian people.
Over to you, Mr. Ahmed. Now, what is being done to ensure that the Israeli regime does not succeed in its plans to infiltrate the African Union?
That decision was postponed until 2023. The good news is actually it helped us, the activists in African continent, actually to restart a continental campaign on the reality of the Zionist regime, which is actually the last colonial project on the earth today. So today, it allows us actually to re-energize the awareness raising, the popular education campaign in many parts in the African continent. But we are facing a lot of corrupt dictatorial regime within the African Union. And we know also that the Zionist regime are very, very good when it comes to corrupting elite, political elite.
South Africa is one of the countries that vehemently opposed Israeli regime's efforts to obtain observer status at the African Union. The country's foreign minister says there can be no justification for the African Union chairperson granting observer status to the Israeli regime.
We believe despite the commission chair having these powers delegated to him, the matter is of such importance, because it's not the first time it's come before the AU, and it was not agreed to previously on two occasions.
Well, we now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall continue with our discussion on the International Codes Day and the significance of this day for the people of Africa. So stay with us.
Codes Day in Africa.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back to this week's edition of Africa Today, which is focusing on Africa and the International Codes Day. Now, over the past years, thousands of people across Africa have marched in solidarity with Palestine on the annual International Codes Day. Now, despite the success of these rallies, activists believe there is need to create strong lobby groups in the continent to counter the Israeli regime's propaganda. Now, Professor, what is being done within the civil society in Africa to create more awareness about Israeli regime's crimes and occupation of Palestine?
There are two significant entities in South Africa that are working on this front, particularly in relation to, to Africa. The one is Africa for Palestine. Africa for Palestine, we've been around in some form for, and I'm on the board of Africa for Palestine. We've been around for about 15 years now in some form. And we concentrate largely on lobbying the government. We have, I think, significant contact with and influence in our influence with our government. And I think that we have done a huge amount of work, and we have contributed to our government's stand on the Tel Aviv regime. I think that if it weren't for that particular organization, then the South African relationship with Tel Aviv would have been much stronger than what it is at the moment. So we've done a good bit of that.
The Israeli regime and its religious authorities hold racist attitudes towards Africans, especially those living in the occupied territories. In 2018, one of the Israeli regime's two chief rabbis, Yitzhak Yosef, called black people monkeys and the Hebrew equivalent of the N-word in a weekly sermon. Even Ethiopian Jews who moved to the occupied territories continue to face systematic discrimination, racism, and are treated as second-class citizens by the Israeli regime.
Additionally, Ethiopian women in the occupied territories have also been injected with a controversial contraceptive without their knowledge or consent. Now, after initial denials, the Israeli regime admitted that it gave thousands of Ethiopian women shots of Depo-Provera. Activists say this action by the Israeli regime may fit the legal definition of genocide. Now, one of the women coerced to take the controversial contraceptive speaks here.
At the meeting, they said, you don't need to give birth so many times. If you give birth a lot, you will suffer in life. You need a job in Israel. So we said, if that's true, we will never be able to get out of here. So we took the shot.
The Israeli regime wants to establish ties with African countries, yet it discriminates against Africans, including African Jews in the occupied territories. Mr. Ahmad, what's your take on this?
It's not a surprise to see the hypocrisy of the Zionist regime